is Thursday, January 27th. The 23rd. We will begin where we left off yesterday. But before I do, I want to introduce someone who's joined us today. We are honored to have her. We have the governor's health policy advisor, the newly appointed Erin Kelly Seal. So please stand up. No, you got to stand up when we do this. So everyone can see her. Thanks for coming. With that, I will turn this back over to Bob. Proceed ahead, introduce our other distinguished guest that has joined us today, and we'll turn it over to you as proceed with the same format we did yesterday.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob DeCrete. I'm the Deputy Administrator at the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. And with me today is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who will soon be the Administrator of that same office.
Correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I look forward to working with everyone.
I want to take up where we left off yesterday with just a quick review. So far, we've spent a little time talking about the fact that the healthcare finance and delivery system really does not operate, at least not effectively as a system. And we talked about insurance status and the importance of insurance to gaining access to care that can keep people healthy and, in fact, keep them alive. Talk a little bit about the differences between Oregon and the nation as a whole. Then did a quick review of managed care in Oregon, both the history of managed care and current enrollment levels in the various programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and in private insurance. And then talk a little bit about how these parts of the system that doesn't work very well as a whole are interconnected or linked in ways that mean that when we grab a hold of one part of the system, make a change or make a mistake or have any effect whatsoever, it tends to show up rather quickly in other parts of the healthcare system. Some of the ways that happens most obviously are that if you have people who are uninsured seeking care, typically they can't pay for it. That results in cost shift, and those costs get passed along to purchasers who are paying for health care. Similarly, if you have purchasers of health care or health insurance who are not paying what it takes to cover the actual cost of care at the provider level, that results in a loss that gets passed along as well. Then we began talking just a little bit. We're, in fact, on page 19 of the presentation.
About the new presentation.
Yes. I should add that there is a revised version of the presentation. The differences are few, but I corrected some language that caused confusion around costs and reimbursement, and now it's clear that that table that talks about expenditures is, in fact, talking about expenditures by purchasers and not by the cost of care at the provider level. I also included some examples of Medicare expenditures in other states to illustrate the fact that Oregon's are comparatively low. And then it also includes two charts, the first of which comes right after page 20, and the second of which comes after page 21. And, in fact, we can start on page 20, which is a summary of national health care spending. The most important message about health care spending at the national level is that it's going up at an alarming rate. In 2001, it grew by about 10% per person, and it reached $1.4 trillion. So that's the price tag, expenditures for health care in the United States. It also reached 14% of the gross domestic product. This is, by the way, much higher than most of the other countries with comparable health care systems. I think in many of even most European countries, healthcare spending is in the range of 5 to 8% of gross domestic product. So in the area of half the rate of gross domestic product we're spending in the United States.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Cruz.
Bob, how much of that is actual cost increase and how much is increased access?
It's we'll cover that in a little bit of detail in a moment, but it includes both increases in the underlying medical consumer price index, which has gone up about 5% for the last few years. A lot of it, though, is increased utilization and intensity. Representative Cruz, I think that speaks to what you... In any case...
Excuse me, Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to ask a question that you probably can't answer right now, and I can't either. When we compare ourselves to other countries, there are some things that are quite different in our system that drive this. One, we haven't got a uniform system, but I'd also like to see what our hospital costs are compared to other countries, what our pharmaceutical costs are to other countries, and what the expected effect of tort is on our system, because we have a unique tort system with contingency fees and no caps and all the problems we have with that system that we're talking about in another venue. Okay, thanks.
This must be an interesting slide, Bob, because we're generating a lot of questions. Representative March.
Well, anytime you're talking about a complete amount of spending, and I pictured us being much different than a lot of other countries, I wondered how much might also be included in elective type surgery. I mean, you might think of LASIK surgery, which is often considered an elective cosmetic surgery, et cetera. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of going back to Representative Cruz's comment about, you know, access and frequency and incidence. Of course, right.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And this may be covered later on. Will we at some point have information also to show where the U.S. falls in conjunction with overall health quality compared to amount maybe of GDP with different countries? It'd be interesting. Mortality, you know, infant wellness, things like that.
Thank you. Yes, in fact, I'm going to defer a little bit to Dr. Goldberg on this. I'll just say that I'm aware of some studies that have been done, I think, by the World Health Organization on outcomes.
There have been a lot. I don't have the figures off the top of my head, but we'll get you some information regarding how how the U.S. stacks up around infant mortality and a variety of other indicators of health. I mean, really what you're asking is, what do you get for the dollars we spend? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the issue.
Thanks. In the period 1990 to 2000, and here it may be helpful to look at the chart on the next page, healthcare expenditures grew from 12% to 13.2% of GDP. So that's a 1.2% increase over a decade. When you compare that with an increase of nearly 1% in 1 year, you can see why the recent increases in healthcare spending have gotten a lot of attention. So what we're seeing is a steep upturn in 2001 as compared with previous periods. What makes this so important in its effect on what happens with the cost of health insurance and the ability of people to get health insurance is that when the GDP is growing slowly, as it is now, but the cost of health care and health insurance are spiking, it becomes unaffordable quickly, not just to employees, but to employers, too. So everyone feels the pinch.
And I assume, Bob, the forecast is for this trend to increase and grow at an accelerated pace.
Mr. Chair, everything that I'm reading now indicates that the underlying factors, if we don't get a handle on them, will continue to cause a steep increase in the cost of care. Yeah.
Social demographic, medical technology.
Right. We'll cover those in just a minute, but okay, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. The rates of growth in healthcare costs over the last three decades, and this is the second chart that's in your packet on page 21, and the chart is on the following page, took a dip in the 1990s and then started heading back up. And this goes to 2000, and we're at the very beginning then of the current increase in the cost of health care. What you'll notice is that for prescription drugs, which is the top bar on the graph here, it holds pretty steady at about 13-12%. Other kinds of services saw a marked decrease in the 90s and then have started back up again. On page 22, we start talking about what you've just been asking questions about, which is what what are the factors that are contributing to the increase in health care spending? The underlying medical consumer price... Mr. Chair.
I hate to keep interrupting you, but I thought this format worked very well yesterday. You're talking about on page...
1A.
20, and then the graph on 20A, 14-15% growth. I don't see anything in this cost on your chart on 21A that is pushing 14%. I mean, you
add them together.
This is just before the spike. This takes us up just to the brink of the.
This only goes to 2000.
This is recent history. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just takes you up to the point where we're now experiencing the acceleration, but it gives you the trends over the last period.
Okay. Understand. Thank you. Please proceed.
The underlying medical consumer price index is what people think of when they think of inflation in the cost of health care, but it's really a small part of the phenomenon, about 5%, and it's holding fairly steady. It's utilization increases that are driving up the cost of health care so steeply. And this has to do with volume and intensity of services. How much service is being provided, and if you look at a unit of service, whatever that is, a prescription, a day in the hospital, a physician visit, how intense is the service being provided? How much technology is being used? What's the cost of that technology? How much health care is being provided? And what we're seeing is an increase in that factor that's dramatic. The result is double-digit increases in the premiums that are charged for private insurance and increased cost-sharing for Medicaid and Medicare. And again, when premiums rise faster than wages, what we see in the private sector, where, as you'll remember, about 60% of us have our health insurance, is pressure that can cause additional workers to drop their health insurance because it becomes unaffordable, or cause employers to decide that they can no longer continue offering health insurance and stay in business. And that's, you'll hear more about this when Rocky King makes his presentation on the private insurance area, but the phenomenon we're experiencing right now is intense pressure on the cost of private health insurance. Any questions on that?
Maybe I should maybe save some of these for Rocky because it's in his field. But do you know, for example, do we have data that shows any escalators relative to mandated testing services? I mean, there's been a flood over the last few years of various states, and we've done some in Oregon and contemplated others of different screenings and stuff like that become mandated and so are consequently more highly utilized than they had been before. And a lot of those tests are relatively spendy to do. I mean, do we have data that shows that type of relationship?
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I don't have that information, okay, but I'll see if I can find out.
Okay. Yeah, and like I said, that may be a more appropriate question for Rocky, but you're here.
It's a fair question.
Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question on panel 22, the first line, inflation and medical consumer price index. I guess I had read a report from NCSL that said that the medical inflation was one of the big drivers of the increase in the cost of health care. So I guess I'm confused. Is that the same thing as this MCPI, or is that something separate?
No, I think that is the same thing, but what I've read is, Representative Dalto, that although it's a factor, most of the increase recently is because of increased utilization and intensity. I think it's a question of how much the problem is due to increases in the cost of the goods that are being used, that are part of providing health care, and how much is due to the fact that there's more technology being applied each time a person goes into the office or into the hospital. And I don't mean to imply that it's not a factor, but I think from what I have read, most of the increase in 2001 was due to volume and intensity, increases in utilization.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I guess maybe the question would be then what definitions we're using. I mean, just a rhetorical question, what definitions of inflation we're using. Maybe their definition is different than the one that we're using here so that we have a different sort of outcome. Thank you.
Mr. Representative Dolto, if I can get the information from you, I will look into that and see what difference there may be.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had also read somewhere that managed care organizations had suppressed their prices in competition for market share, and that essentially that had run its course, and that this kind of a spring, and in many cases they had run a deficit, if you will, and that there's, so that had kind of obscured the increase in cost of medical services, and that now we're seeing, is that a piece of this jump, this sudden jump from in 1 year that we're looking at?
That's certainly a piece. I mean, what managed care organizations have tried to do is to hold the line on some of the prices, and there's only they've only been able to do that for so long, and then eventually the market rebels. And you'll see some information, I believe, coming up later, or you saw it earlier, about how certain consolidations in the marketplace mean that it's very difficult for people to keep those, to be able to provide the service without paying an increased cost.
But I didn't hear that as your real question. I mean, what I heard was, is did managed care organizations artificially mask prices to gain market share, kept them, that's more where you were going, and I didn't hear an answer to that.
I think that really speaks to what the motivation of managed care organizations were, and I don't know. I think it's multifactorial. I think there was clearly aims to get market share and try and deliver a product at a price that people can afford. I think that there were efforts to control costs were a piece of that. I think it's all of the above.
And then making an assumption that if that went on, that's an if, that when they either A, got tired of that practice, or B, assumed the percentage market share they wanted, then they started charging truer cost, and the result was a steeper increase in prices.
That's a piece. And I think the piece that ties it together with the previous question is we certainly haven't seen prices of any services decrease.
Right.
Even as we've seen utilization of technologies increase, and you would think as many other places in the market where as something becomes more commonplace, as it's produced more often, that actually prices tend to fall, that we don't see that happening. Actually, we see increases in utilization and increases in price as even utilization increases.
And is that what you're trying to get at when you're talking about, you know, volume and intensity of service, that each visit, if you will, is a more expensive occurrence?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chair. I think the phenomenon is that more is being done each time a service is provided, either more testing, more intensity of treatment, just more resources are being used per visit or per prescription written or per hospital bed day.
Yeah, I just wanted to flesh out that intensity. Mm-hmm. I thought that's where you were going, but Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess it seems to me that the consumer and medical consumers is paying the cost of the R&D for these latest and greatest treatment systems or whatever. I mean, we're paying for it. Everybody's paying for it at the end. Just an observation.
Appreciate that.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested in kind of looking at some concrete examples. For example, like an MRI, the cost of an MRI is, and I remember vaguely, like an MRI machine in the 80s was about $2 million if you want to go out and buy one. And then the price dropped down to, I think you could get one for close to $1 million. But did the price for an MRI exam drop.
That's exactly what I was alluding to. No, and we can give you some information on what the charges have been for those and the cost of the equipment.
Thank you.
Okay, let's let these guys turn over at least three pages in a row. Unless you're burning to ask a question. I'm not trying to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
At least the class is paying attention.
The next page gets at some of the drivers of the volume and intensity. And again, I think this gets to some questions that have been asked already. We have an aging population. And because of that, there's a greater need for care. That's the first factor. Second is that we had a spread of more comprehensive insurance in the 90s that led to greater access with higher use of new technologies, including drugs and more intensive treatment. So more people had the kind of coverage that pays for that higher intensity care. There's also an element of defensive medicine, it's referred to, which is medicine that the practice includes attempts to make certain that there's not going to be either an increase in medical liability insurance premiums or some other action coming back on the provider that's going to cause them problems. And I guess I would defer to the clinicians who are available to speak to how much of the this may be due to that.
It is significant. There's no question about it. In a hospital setting, it's even more significant. Hospitals' employees have to go through tremendous amounts of documentation and work to be in a position that they can defend themselves in case of a lawsuit. It's a huge amount of money. And that's what defensive medicine is all about. We can't make it. We don't really know what it is. It's part of doing business. I'll speak with you.
In addition, there are new technologies being invented every year, including diagnostic and testing procedures, new prescription drugs, new technologies of all kinds. All of these have research and development costs. All of them are more expensive at the beginning. Some of them are very effective. Consumer demand is greater for some of them that has not much to do with effectiveness. It all increases demand and utilization because the care is available, and people, if they need it, want it to be provided to them. And in the hospital, we have higher intensity care provided per hospital bed day or per hospital stay. In Oregon, we do very well in terms of not having people stay in the hospital very long compared with other states. That doesn't mean that we aren't seeing an increase in the intensity of care provided during each day that people are in the hospital. We're still, like every other state and the nation as a whole, seeing increases in the cost of care per hospital day.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Chair. To what degree do, and I'm thinking of some of the public health issues that we're seeing emerging, childhood obesity, increases in diabetes, are there, to what degree is public health playing into these volume intensity drivers as well, or is that still on the horizon and it's going to see us in the near future?
We'll see it in the near future. What we've seen is tremendous benefits from such things as smoking cessation, which have actually kept, this would have been, the curves would have been steeper if we still had 40 or 50% of our population smoking. But clearly, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, a variety of other public health issues will create costs down the road. Obesity is the largest risk factor for diabetes. We will, as we see a population which is more overweight, the incidence of diabetes will increase. As the incidence of diabetes increases, the expenditures for pharmaceuticals to treat diabetes and to treat the complications of diabetes will increase. So that will happen.
Go ahead, sir.
The next page deals with some emerging cost drivers. The first is provider consolidation, increasing market leverage. There's evidence that providers are becoming more able because they're grouping together in practice associations and other organizations to negotiate in the marketplace to get closer what they think is a reimbursement that covers the cost of care. There's also direct-to-consumer advertising resulting in higher demand for new technologies. An example is prescription drugs. We've had a reduction in managed care controls because of what's called backlash against managed care. What this means is that there's greater patient choice of providers now, even if you're in a managed care plan. Tends to be a greater variety of physicians you can see, not a closed panel as opposed to an open panel. And fewer constraints on specialty care. It's easier for people to get a referral to see a specialist, and specialty care is typically more expensive. So again, these impact utilization. We've also had some provider capacity reductions, which prompt price increases. And this is simply a question of when the supply goes down, the demand and the price can go up. And examples here are, first, the phenomenon that many Oregonians are finding, that it's more difficult to find a physician who's taking new patients. And then typically there are longer waits to get an appointment and more time spent in the waiting room. We also have, in Oregon, an emerging nursing shortage. We're doing things about that. But right now there is a serious problem regarding the adequacy of the supply of nurses to support the provision of medical care. So anytime we have an undersupply of one of the components of the healthcare system, we can expect to see an increase in cost there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a point that we will reach in Oregon where we will not have a sufficient number of nurses to meet the demand, that we will fall into some sort of federal, you know, we'll break some rule and then, you know, we'll have something come down on us?
The hospitals are struggling with that. Hospitals need to maintain staffing levels, and what we actually see is hospitals who have vacant beds, I mean, that they have the actual physical bed, but they're closed to admissions because they don't have the safe staffing to actually put individuals in those beds. We're approaching those sorts of situations.
Well, and not to put words in Representative Dalto's mouth, but I think his question was, is there any federal compliance minimums that we are in jeopardy of falling below? I understood the physical side of what you just said, which is...
But I think what I was trying to get at, excuse me, is that hospitals won't put themselves out of compliance. In other words, they will...
Leave the bed vacant.
Exactly. So I don't think anyone is going to try and we are at risk for doing that. The issue will be, rather than put oneself out of compliance with staffing patterns, it will be to be unable to provide the service when it's needed. Does that get at?
Very good. Thank you. Representative Bates.
The question that Representative Dalto has asked is actually very germane, where we might be in a few years, and that would cause the implosion of the system. Right now, what happens commonly as an intensive care patient, as an example, in Roseburg, is you need to be on a ventilator in an ICU. And that hospital may say, we've got the beds or we have enough nursing to maintain that. They can't keep them in the emergency room on a ventilator because it's against federal statutes. And so they ship the patient to Eugene or to Medford. Eugene and Medford finally become too crowded that particular night, they have to go to Portland. If everything in the, every intensive care bed in the state is filled, what do? You've got an ICU patient, you're out of compliance, you've got nowhere to go now. And that hasn't happened yet in the state. But when I get a transfer of an ICU patient to Medford, as I did a month ago from Roseburg, a woman coming down in an ambulance on a ventilation machine, then we've got a serious problem. And that's what we're starting to see as the system starts to implode. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
In the next few years, we might actually see the scenario you're talking about. What do you do with that kind of patient when there's no place to go?
And is a compounding factor then also that as hospitals have higher demand for nurses, that has a ripple effect on, for example, nursing facilities that compete and often can't the same wage, and then so as hospitals compete on wages, it kind of drives it to the other end where you're going to see problems in our long-term care system. It's legitimate to say we're going to see problems in other places, even if the hospitals can kind of balance it out.
nursing care is a part of just about all pieces of the health delivery system. And so as the cost of nursing care increases, that's a piece of health expenditures, so it will be everywhere. Nursing homes, physicians' offices, everywhere.
So let me sum this up. We've got no money. We've got a model we can't afford, and on top of all that, we've got these cost drivers that are about ready to, you know, come down on our heads. Plus, we have a physical capacity issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no problem.
And we're in competition with other states for the resources.
Perfect. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me. So I guess I have one last point, which is as we start to see our capacity fill in the scenario that Representative Bates, Dr. Bates described, we're going to have to spend a lot of money on importing nurses as we did at OHSU for the time that we had to, for the time that had to be done. Is there a study that has been done, or do you have the capability to produce data to show how, I guess my question is, do you have the capability to produce data to show how nursing, the individual cost of nursing is driving these increases isolated on an isolated level? Thank you.
We can try and get that for you.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, the next section has to do with likely stakeholder responses, both in Oregon and nationally, again, to the set of circumstances we just talked about. First stakeholder that I want to talk about is employers, and especially small employers who are feeling, I think, the pinch even worse in Oregon. What we're seeing, and I think can expect to see more of, is an increase in employee cost sharing. In other words, employers will negotiate with health plans for coverage that requires the employee to pay a higher cost, both the premium, because employees typically share in about the cost of the premium for family coverage, small employers in Oregon, and cost sharing at the time of service. So what we've begun to see, and I think we'll continue to see, is that the health insurance that people get through their employment will change, and more of the responsibility for paying for health care will be shifted to the employee. Another place we're going to see the tightening is reduction in benefits. This has been limited so far. Instead, most of the changes we've seen are increases in cost sharing, but at some point, I think the pressure is going to come back on benefits, and employers will talk with employees about which benefits they would miss the least if they were eliminated from the benefit package. We can also expect to see decreased employer contributions to the premium, both for dependents and for employees. Often, the way this plays out is that the employer will continue to pay a considerable share of the premium for the employee, but will drop the contribution if it's family coverage, which means that you'll have families in which the worker is still insured through the employment, but not the dependents. But we're also going to see more employers decide that they won't begin offering health insurance. They may have been considering it and looking into prices, and they may decide that they simply can't afford it and stay in business. And I also expect that we'll see more employers decide that although they have been offering health insurance in the past, it's something they have to take a hard look at and decide if they can continue to offer health insurance to both workers and dependents in the future. So in the message here is that the increases in the cost of health care and health coverage are exerting a lot of pressure on employers who are making decisions about whether to offer health insurance and, if they do, how much they can afford to contribute to that health insurance. Part of the shift we're seeing there is away from what used to be called defined benefits, where the employer says, I'm going to provide these benefits to my employees no matter what it costs, so to speak, and defined contributions, where the employer says, this is how much I can afford to contribute to the cost of your health insurance. Now let's see what we can buy for that amount. And I think we'll see more businesses thinking of their health insurance for employees in terms of the contribution and what the business can afford. Similar pressures are being felt by employees an employer-sponsored insurance, it's really the employers and the employees who share in the cost of health insurance. It's a part of the total compensation package, and employees are finding themselves in a position where they're having to turn down health insurance offered by employers because their employee share of the premium has become unaffordable. Again, this has to do with the fact that the rest of the economy is not growing as fast as the cost of health care and health coverage, so wage increases are not keeping up with what employees are being asked to pay as their share of health insurance. As co-payments or co-insurance increase, people start to avoid seeking care if the cost-sharing seems unaffordable. And what this means is you may have health insurance that gives you a benefit, let's say for preventive care, for physical exams. But it may be that the co-payment required of you for that exam this year, instead of being $10, is $35. If your income is low enough and if there are enough other issues in the family budget that seems like too much to pay, you may go without that visit to the physician because you don't want to pay that co-payment. This is sometimes referred to as...
Bob?
Yes.
On that, I guess the how the profile of Oregon's insurance is changing over time, do we have a way to kind of glean what that's looked like over the last few years? Are we seeing a shift? And is there a way somehow to map that? It may be an insurance division question, but I guess I'm kind of curious to what degree is Oregon kind of changing in terms of its overall co-payment? Is it?
Yes.
I'm not sure how the question should be stated, but kind of a longitudinal kind of look at that whole system, if we can somehow view it. It may not be available, it may be too obscure.
Yeah, Mr. McCorvin, I'm going to give a quick answer, and then I'm going to defer to Kelly Harms, who's here from the Insurance Pool Governing Board.
I can't tell him. I'm just going to give a
quick response and then speak of a survey that they're going to do.
Well, and she can maybe, if they're going to come up later in the week, we'll just defer that till then.
Let me just give you a very quick response. We are doing some work to try and get information about what changes are taking place right now in private health insurance. The folks who administer the FEOP program have recently revised what they call their benchmark, and that is a tool for deciding whether health insurance meets the requirements we want to have in place so that it is good enough to subsidize. So before FEOP decides to spend its resources subsidizing health insurance, it does a check on the benefits and the cost sharing to make sure that it meets that standard. They're revising that because of changes, in fact, recently in employer-sponsored insurance. We're also going to be doing a survey of employers in Oregon to find out what changes they've had recently in the health insurance. First of all, whether they offer, and if they do offer, what changes there have been in the benefits and in the cost sharing. We hope to have the results of that survey late in the spring. So we should be able to share much more information with you on that later. But in the meantime, the work that went into revising the benchmark, I think, is going to answer some of your questions about changes. We do know it's changing. We know that the cost sharing is going up, and we know the benefits are under pressure, and some benefits are about to be eliminated. We also are beginning to see an impact, and I anticipate we'll see a greater impact, on the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. This is the high-risk pool in Oregon. It's a program for people who are uninsured and who can't get insurance in the open marketplace because of a pre-existing condition. And there are also some requirements about whether COBRA, or continuing health insurance from employment, is available to them. But essentially, it's a program for folks who would be uninsurable on the open marketplace because they're high risk. They have a pre-existing condition. And as folks leave or lose employer-sponsored insurance, some of those will come on to the OMEP high-risk pool program as the only way that they can then pick up health insurance.
Just a quick statement.
Yes.
As I understand it, not every state has an OMIP counterpart. This is rather unique to Oregon. And you know roughly how many states?
Roughly a dozen, I would say, or is it more than that?
30 states have
similar programs.
The next stakeholder I want to talk about is states themselves, and here I'm talking about some responses that will be very familiar to us as Oregonians, but they're national again, seeing them across the country. Okay. Medicaid benefits are being reduced. There are increases in states requesting the federal government for permission to do cost sharing so that Medicaid recipients pay a small amount when they use services or a small share of the premium. There are limits being placed on Medicaid eligibility. Either they're decreasing the amount of money you can have and still get onto the program, or otherwise taking blocks of people off the eligibility for Medicaid. And there's pressure that's resulting in reduction in Medicaid payments to providers in some states. So the same pressures we're feeling in Oregon are being felt across the country. What this means in practical terms is that the federal government, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that administers the Medicaid program, is hearing from many states that the plans that they recently developed to expand their Medicaid programs are not going to be feasible given the revenue picture. So we can expect that the government will be, I think, increasing its flexibility to let states make the changes that they have to make to keep their programs somewhat intact under the current budget pressures. The next stakeholder is the federal government itself. Now, in recent past, the federal government has discussed the prospect of federal revenue sharing to help states that are having a particularly hard time with their state economies by giving them additional federal money for their Medicaid programs. I don't know what the prospect is that this is actually going to come to pass. I'm afraid I'm not optimistic. I think federal priorities being what they are now, we shouldn't expect that to happen in the near future. Federal government is increasing the number of Medicaid waivers it grants and the amount of flexibility they're willing to allow under those waivers, so there is an opportunity to take to the federal government more creative proposals for restructuring Medicaid programs. And the federal government itself is reducing its payments to some providers. We talked about this previously, but the Medicare payments to physicians were reduced last budget cycle, may be reduced again this next budget cycle.
Refresh my memory, Bob. For Medicaid, the reimbursement rate is what? And Medicare, its round number is what?
Reimbursement at what level, Mr. Chair, for the
For the health plan. That we funnel those dollars through.
I think what he wants to know is the match rate.
No, not the match rate.
How much you pay? How much they pay physicians?
Yes.
Right now, OMAP is paying roughly $26 per what's called an RVU, which is a relative value unit. Every physician service has a relative value with obviously complex procedures being hundreds of relative value units and an office visit being two relative value units. $26 is what OMAP pays. Medicare is, in this state, about 36. Alan, am I 36?
Fractured higher, but that's about right.
And commercial insurance is closer to $50, $55.
Just to give you a little heartburn, in some states, the Medicare RVU is higher than the commercial RVU.
Yeah.
And you think about the cost shift, that's why.
I mean, this is in essence one of the big issues, is that the same service, the exact same service, if someone were to go see Dr. Bates and for the exact same for treatment of their pneumonia, depending on their insurance, the reimbursement could be anywhere from $26 for that service to $37 for that service to $55 for that service, exact same service provided.
And to reinforce, we have no control this time over the Medicare. We have some significant control over the Medicaid through matched dollars, but we still have a limit placed on us because it has to be budget neutral. So we have some good control there, but not complete control on that either. Basically, I like to think of it as that the federal government and the Medicare program is doing a number on us, there's another phrase, and that in the Medicaid program, we're helping them do the number on us. But you know, it's a bad system for Oregon.
That was an extremely helpful answer, at least for me, in terms of reimbursement. And you'll have you know, I talked to Walden last night, and he does not see any way, shape, or form the Medicare reduction that's currently in the pipeline, that 4.5% going through. He doesn't think that's
good. Good. That'll take some pressure off us.
He thinks that the, you know, one man talking here, he thinks the they've had some pharmacy benefits to Medicare, but does not think that some of the discussions regarding the Medicaid increases will go. So,
good.
Mixed bag, but
yeah. See.
That's up.
They do much on prescription drugs. It's got a lower rate.
Please proceed. Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. That RVU explanation was just. That's
how it is.
Yep. No, that helps a lot. Please proceed.
The next stakeholder I wanted to talk a little bit about is managed care plans. As I mentioned, they're offering less restrictive managed care products to meet market demand for more choice and more flexibility. I mentioned the backlash against HMOs and managed care. I think, you know, basically what happened was that managed care HMOs did what people asked them to do, and that is to contain costs. But people weren't happy with the way that costs were contained or how it felt as patients. So we're moving away from some of the most effective measures. Managed care plans had to contain costs, and the question is, what then do we do instead? We've lost one of the factors that slowed down the increasing cost in healthcare, and the question is, what do we do instead? Managed care plans are also seeking less contentious contracting terms with providers so they can build a broader panel and provide a wider choice to patients. And they're taking steps to protect their financial viability, given their erosion of the ability to control costs. It's tough for managed care plans these days because they're asking to back away from what they did for a number of years to help to keep the cost of health care down.
What do you mean by that? Help me out. Flesh that out. I don't know. They're being asked to back away from what they did traditionally for a number of years.
I think the classic HMO model maybe Kaiser. And Kaiser, as one of the rules of being an insured person at Kaiser, restricted people to using only the Kaiser physicians and to using the Kaiser physicians according to the rules of that system. A lot of people didn't want that, so chose another health plan. But a lot of the other health plans use some of the same kinds of restrictions. They didn't allow people to refer themselves to specialists, for example. That had to be done by the primary care physician, or the visit wouldn't be paid. There were protocols for physicians making decisions to admit people to the hospital that the managed care plans used to make sure that they were able to control hospital utilization. Choice in a lot of ways was restricted as a way to keep costs under control. And when people began to complain about the fact that they didn't have as much choice as they wanted when they were in managed care plans have started to look at more flexible arrangements. One of these is called point of service. And in a nutshell, the way that operates is that at the point where you're going to be using health care, you can make a decision to go outside the smaller panel of providers. But if you do, you're going to pay more of the cost of that service yourself. So, and I'll turn to Dr. Goldberg for other ways in which managed care plans may be changing the way that they do business.
I think your question was different. I think, were you asking about the last point here about taking steps to protect financial viability, which I think what, Bob, what you may have been saying at its most base form is, if you can't control the cost, you increase the revenue. So if you can't control the cost of the health care that's being delivered, what you do is you either raise the premium or you keep the premium the same and have the subscriber pay an additional fee in terms of a cost share in some way, a copayment. It's simple economics that if you can't control the cost, you raise the price, because if the cost is going up, you're not going to sell something at below the cost.
And Bobby, maybe it leads into your question. If we're seeing, for example, say decrease, and I know we've seen nationally a decrease in the use of HMOs, as that number drops, are people leaning more towards then like preferred provider type of model, some kind of hybrid indemnity? What are we seeing kind of sprout out of that as that model kind of decreases?
Well, I think you're seeing more people enroll in PPOs or plans like that that expand the range of providers you can see, but also ask you to make decisions about how much you're going to be willing to pay, depending on how much choice you exercise. I think it's pretty difficult to find any managed care plan that hasn't made some changes over the last few years to try and appeal more to people who want a little bit more control over which providers they see and a little bit more choice about the care they receive.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, is one of the ways of containing costs to reduce lines of service? Is that an acceptable way to contain costs at this point?
That's called limiting the benefits. So it limits the type of service you can get, whether that's actually excluding something, a policy which says physical therapy isn't covered, or a policy that covers a limited service, X number of a particular item.
Representative Bitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, I don't know the answer to this question myself, and I don't know if you can find it for us. We've talked about the cost drivers for this incredible increase in the last two or three years in the cost of health care. And I wonder if there's a correlation between HMOs basically being eliminated from our system, because what they mainly did was control utilization. They kept people from unnecessary hospitalization, unnecessary visits to subspecialists, things that a lot of people like to have, but in fact didn't make much difference in health care. People didn't like that change. But what I'm wondering is if the primary driver in this thing is increased utilization since we've lost the HMOs. I mean, we think that helped healthcare costs down in the mid-90s. Now we have a whole bunch of drivers. We're not sure which ones are driving this the most. And it'd be interesting to see that. I know that some healthcare policies have not suffered double-digit inflation, but they're closed systems for the most part and have maintained managed care. So we might want to look at those systems that have maintained that lower inflationary rate and see if utilization is the main factor in controlling it. I don't know if you get that information for us or not.
I will try. I think that would be good information if we can find it.
You know which ones I've talked about.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes. This next section is some thinking about what the future may hold given these pressures on the healthcare system in particular, on the cost of healthcare. And I think the first thing we're going to see is increased attention to three questions. We've been talking about them in Oregon for quite some time, but I don't think they're going to go away. The first is what benefits should be covered. Second is who should be eligible for which coverage under what programs. And the third is how should payment levels be determined. I think this has been at the heart of the discussion about the Oregon Health Plan for some time. And I think it will continue to be. These are the three big pieces you can take a look at in trying to get a handle on restructuring the Oregon Health Plan. The next issue, I think, is going to be that purchasers, whether it's employers and employees or the government or individuals in the individual market, are going to become increasingly unable to meet the double-digit increases in the cost of health care and health coverage if the current trends continue. The effects of having double-digit inflation on insurance premiums for 2, 3, especially 4 years in a row are pretty staggering. And I think, you know, the evidence in Oregon is clear that the pressure on the cost of health insurance for employers in Oregon is intense. If growth in the general economy lags behind growth in health care costs, if that continues, the problem is going to get worse. There's going to be a bigger gap between people's increases in purchasing power and what they're being asked to pay for their health insurance or their health care. And it appears as though the federal government priorities are going to make increased federal revenue sharing with states unlikely, at least for the next few years. Again, there's been discussion of that. It would be a great help if the federal government were to say that for states that have, let's say, an unemployment rate greater than 6.5%, the federal match rate would go higher than it is for that, as long as the unemployment was above that level. I don't know what the prospects are for that coming to pass. Regarding benefits, I think we can expect a higher priority is going to be placed on health outcomes. Again, it gets back to what you're purchasing for the dollar spent and what health care, what health coverage and what health care have the greatest effect on improving health. I think as a part of that, cost sharing and publicly funded programs may be revised so that we build in incentives favoring care that maximizes better health outcomes. If there are ways to restructure benefit packages so that we feel more confident that people are going to get the kind of care that's going to keep them healthy and prevent avoidable specialty care and hospitalizations, I think that's going to become important. I think there may also be a continuing public consultation on health values and priorities, such as we had with the Oregon Health Plan and the prioritized list. And the value of that, I think, is that that input can help to determine which benefits are most important to cover and where the cost sharing should be applied. I think one of the strengths of the way that the prioritized list was put together was that the Health Services Commission did pay close attention to what the people who were going to be covered said about what was important to them, what was not important. And I think that that is critical if you're going to ask people to make sacrifices, that they feel that they've been consulted and have had some input. I think the pressure on benefits is going to be across the board, not simply in Medicaid, but also in private health insurance and on Medicare as well. Regarding financing, I think we can expect the federal government is going to continue to look to states and the private sector for direction on health reform, including how it ought to be financed. I don't see any real prospects that there's going to be a national solution to the problems with health care finance. You may be wrong, may be fooled. I'd be delighted.
Thank you, Chair. The question, that similar question is posed to Diane Rowland, who's executive
yes.
director of the Kaiser Family Foundation, during a health conference that Dr. Bates and some others attended, and what was her crystal ball for the future. And it was asked after we heard several states present on their waiver programs and how unique they were, but how they were also facing all these problems. And her response was that it's kind of a finger, the waivers and the states are basically putting fingers in the dikes, and that she foresees perhaps something happening on a national level with health care, and didn't go into that. I'd be interested at some point, maybe at a later time, just has that been explored? I'm not going down the single payer system discussion or universal health care at this point, but some of the, I know Blue Cross Blue Shields even talked about looking at a universal health care system in a model, and we've heard the governor of Vermont talk that as well. It might be at some point interesting to hear some of those kind of scenarios, and not right this second, but sometime in the future.
I guess the only comment I'd make in response to that is that I think there's always a chance that there will be a solution at the national level, but I don't think we can depend on it in any way. I think the problems are so immediate that, you know, states have to do what they can to address the issues that they have with their Medicaid programs and other health care systems in each state. And those are laboratories. And, you know, the work that's done there will contribute, hopefully someday, to a national solution. I wish I were more optimistic that that's going to happen in the next, let's say, 4 or 5 years, but I guess I'm not. I think not just in Oregon, but I think in states across the country, it's going to become increasingly problematic to tie Medicaid financing to general revenue only. And I say that because What we find is that when state revenues are down from the usual sources for state revenue, it's because the economy has taken a dip and the need for services like Medicaid goes up at that same time. So you're hit with what is sometimes referred to as a double whammy. The resources go down at the same time that the need for assistance by people who find themselves without health insurance goes up. And I think that what that means is that you, at the very time that you want to get a handle on ways to expand coverage for people who need it, you don't have the resources to do it if you don't have a dedicated source of revenue that can be used to develop funding for Medicaid or other health insurance programs. I also think that businesses are going to find themselves unable to sustain their contributions to health insurance premiums at a level that assures employee affordability if we continue to see the increases in premium payments required and if the economy continues to be stagnant in Oregon. What this would mean is that employer-sponsored insurance as a platform for coverage for most people would be put in jeopardy. I can see a real chance that if things don't change over the next 3 or 4 years, the pressures on employer-sponsored insurance, employers and employees, are going to become so intense that that platform for providing health insurance is going to be called into question.
Representative March.
You mentioned new revenue sources dedicated to funding Medicaid. Do you have any suggestions for one that's not, you know, that's recession-proof?
That's a very good question, Representative March. I can't give you a silver bullet. I don't have any particular source of revenues that I think is recession-proof. But I do think that if there's a way to institute a tax or an assessment or some other revenue source that is broad-based and that is dedicated to making health insurance available to people who've lost it because of the downturn in the economy, that there would be public support for it. I think enough people who are not accustomed to worrying about their health insurance are beginning to worry about it, that there may be a political opportunity to look at sources of revenue that would be dedicated to providing health insurance.
Well, maybe besides PERS, members of the legislature will have to cut their health plans as well. So. Mm.
We're not advocating for that.
No. Yeah, let the record show that Representative March is advocating for that.
You? I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to articulate this question very clearly, but what I'm curious about is it seems that there's an aspect to this where as the costs keep rising, but the amount of money that's going in to pay the costs is somewhat static or even falling off, that would have a chilling effect on some of the services that are going on the providing side and have an impact on holding the cost increases down to some extent. Does that make any sense?
It should. I mean, it does make sense, but it's not what's happening. If I understand what you're saying is that if costs are going up and need is going up and there isn't the money to pay for it there, that the natural response would be the need would go away.
No, what I'm saying is would the pressure on that's presented by not enough money going in to pay the costs result in, for example, not as many advanced or new technology type things being introduced because there's no money to buy them, and that having an impact of holding down the cost side?
I don't think that we've seen that happen, because what's happening is that the need, people are getting sick, and the need is always there. People don't postpone getting ill. So it's not as if this is something they put off buying, or they put off occurring, or they plan for. people continue to get sick and the system continues to provide the care, and the costs just continue to get shifted to somebody else. And we're caught in a cycle whereby we all just continue to pay the price, whether it be directly or indirectly. And we're squeezing it out of everybody and everything, whether it's from an employer, whether it's out of an employee's pocket. The need continues, and the services continue to be delivered. Now, I'm not sure I'm answering your question, however.
Well, I would go back to a private sector model where my background is in the timber industry. When the timber industry is doing well and the markets are strong, then we're busy figuring out ways to improve our technology and our means of production. And when the markets fall off, then we stop doing that and we get back to just, you know, trying to push product out the door at the lowest possible cost that we can without looking at making the capital improvements and those kinds of things. Is that same kind of model applicable in an industry like medicine where if you've got you've got to contain costs somehow because your amount of money coming in is static or declining. So you can decrease the benefits, and that point has already clearly been made, but there also must be an aspect to this where you stop buying the latest imaging device or you stop, you know, making those kinds of investments, which would have some kind of cost-limiting aspect to it.
At the point in which people stop buying some of that, there will be less of it. I think we just haven't reached a point yet where there has been the will to actually stop buying any of this. That's number one. I think number two is what's a little bit different about healthcare than, let's say, the timber industry is that much of the research and development not all of the research and development into new technology is funded by the industry itself.
Right.
There's also a fair amount that's funded through the federal government in terms of science. But you said,
Mr. Chair, yeah, no, you're saying it. I agree. The drug companies are researching all the time for new medications. Universities are doing research, like OHSU, on new cancer treatments. So some of that's funded by
federal investments in research and development and in advancing science and knowledge, which then that advancement in science and knowledge get converted into a commercial product.
And demand.
But
demand.
We've yet to, I think you're getting at the issue, is right. We have yet as a society put a stop in the place where we will say we're not going to pay for any more of this, that, or the other thing. We continue to buy it. That is at the crux of the discussion that's going on now.
Thank you.
Did that?
Yeah.
And let me sum up the question and the answer, if I could. I mean, Susan functionally asked you, is there reduced utilization of some of this new medical technology, either through purchase or, say, you walk into the Medford Hospital and, you know, no, you're not going to get the MRI, you're going to get the CAT scan. And that isn't happening.
No. And it's not happening for a variety of reasons. Representative Bates referred to it because there are people who are, there's one, a belief in needing to be certain that you're practicing medicine defensively. I think that there's not a lot of information about the benefits of one particular test or treatment versus another. That's coming up, but one of the key issues here, we touched on it earlier in a bigger sense about what's the value of what you're purchasing. With the 14% of GNP that we spend, why aren't we the healthiest? what outcome do you get, what benefit do you get for what you buy? And we haven't come to grips with that. And we, as a healthcare community, often will continue to say that one technology is actually far better than another, without there really being the evidence that it is. It may be actually that the CAT scan is actually just as good as the MRI, but the data and the information aren't there. And also because no one's paying the true cost of that.
So just to sum that up, what I heard you say is this is all Dr. Bates' fault.
Exactly.
Yeah, it actually is, and I'd like to defend myself for a moment. Representative Morgan, you've raised really one of the ethical and one of the cruxes of the problem of healthcare drivers in the United States, and that is that the people who receive the service, for the most part, are not paying for the service. I've got insurance, I've got Medicaid, I've got Medicare. And so the individual wants the best and demands the best. The physician is trained to do everything he possibly can for the patient, no matter what, no matter the cost. And most of it's not based on scientific outcomes. So you have these things driving this thing forward in a sort of a headlong fashion. And the only time I see, and I think most of us see, any stop to that is the rare patient who's paying for these services out of their own pocket. And when you ask them about an MRI versus CT, one's $1,400 and one's $300, you really get their attention because they're paying for themselves. So there's a sense of responsibility there. On the other hand, it can go the other direction on these people too. I recently had a patient who started experiencing chest pain on a Friday night, 52-year-old woman who had no health insurance, chose not to go to the ER, thought she was waited out, it would go away, and she died at noon the next day at home. So it pushes both ways. Lack of insurance clearly cost her life. But on the other hand, lack of the full insurance drives things to be done which are unnecessary. And to get those two things together is extremely difficult, but not impossible.
Well, the next page starts with a discussion about programs and the impact on programs. I think we finished up, yeah. I think one of the best examples is a homegrown program in Oregon, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, of where pressure is going to be brought to bear to continue a program. FEOP subsidizes employer-sponsored insurance and other private insurance for people who are uninsured, low income. And I think that there's going to be a greater need for that kind of subsidy for employer-sponsored insurance as these pressures continue to be brought to bear on employers and employees and the financing of employer-sponsored insurance. So the demand for FEOP, I think, will increase, and programs like it across the country that subsidize private coverage. For a lot of people, this is really the only acceptable alternative to being uninsured. By that I mean there are folks who will accept a subsidy for their employer-sponsored insurance who would not apply for a Medicaid program for whatever reason. So it's very effective at reaching a portion of the population that is going to, I think, be increasing. I think also we're going to see more Medicaid programs focusing on primary care. I mentioned yesterday that the state of Utah got a waiver for a benefit package that really focuses almost entirely on outpatient care and doesn't provide coverage in the Medicaid portion for inpatient care. And I think that this is a way to limit state expenditures while still promoting access to care. And this could be done based on safety net clinics, for example, so that you've got a platform already in place to provide primary care. I also think we'll see more states developing programs specifically designed for dual eligibles, and these are people who are eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. So they're elderly or disabled, and they're low income. And this means that they are in categories that use a lot of medical care, and a portion of that state is, or that cost comes back to the state as the state share of financing the Medicaid program. So I would expect states to look more closely at what they can do through federal waivers to be creative about programs for dual eligibles. I also expect there to be more pressure on high-risk pools like the Oregon Medical Insurance Program as more people with chronic conditions, pre-existing health conditions, become uninsured because they've lost their coverage at work or wherever they are. I would expect applications to go up there.
Excuse me. Gordon,
could you give me an idea of what the is there a difference between, say, a health care plan were to run $300-$400, say, what would the risk pool, how would that compare? Would it be $800? Would it be $600? Or is there any way to compare?
I'm going to call on someone who actually is involved in administering that program, on Kelly Harms, to answer that question so I don't misinform you.
Representative Gordon.
Anderson.
Anderson. Yeah. And Mr. Chair.
For the record.
For the record, my name is Kelly Harms, and I'm with the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. It is often hard to compare apples and oranges with the plans, but the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, by statute, can charge up to 125% of the rate in the individual market for comparable age groups. So in the OMIP, our prices, most of our people are above 50, so they're at the highest rate that can be charged. And depending on the services that they are purchasing with their plans, we have preferred provider plans, indemnity, and a managed care plan. And those can range anywhere from, trying off the top of my head, $300 up to $600 or $700 based on their age. I can actually bring, when we come and talk about OMIP and FEOP, I will bring our rate sheet so you can see what they cost across the age bands, if that will help. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The next area is eligibility. And one of the things that we've wrestled with the Oregon Health Plan is that we have, in effect, a cliff. If we have income eligibility that stops at a point, and after that you've got nothing available in the way of assistance to get health insurance. The problem with this, of course, is that it can work against people moving to self-reliance. If people know that if their income goes up, they're going to lose their health insurance entirely, they may, in fact, decide that it's not a good idea to seek employment if it's not going to bring health insurance with it. If they've got a family, members of the family need health insurance, it can in fact be a barrier to self-reliance. It's one of the great advantages of having a program with subsidies that can decline as income goes up, which is the case with FEOP. So that after you, as your income increases, you have a few more resources that you can use to help to pay for the cost of your health insurance. The state share, the subsidy, state and federal share, drops. So instead of having this cliff effect where you fall off entirely at a certain income level, there's a ramp. And as you have more resources, fewer state dollars are used to subsidize your health insurance. And I'll also go way out on a limb and say that at some point, if things get bad enough nationally, we may see means testing for Medicare. One of the issues that we have with health insurance in the United States is that the Medicare program provides coverage to people who are aged or disabled regardless of their income. And this is a wonderful benefit for the people who are on it. The problem is that it's paid for to some extent through the taxes paid by people who are uninsured because they're not eligible for a program. So we may see that radical a departure from the way we do things if things get bad enough. The next section has to do with policy questions. And this is an attempt to put some policy issues on the table that will help to structure thinking about where we might want to go from here. And the first set of questions has to do with policy objectives. What are we trying to accomplish as we look at getting ourselves onto a more stable platform? And this would include both the OMAP, Medicaid and CHIP programs, and FEOP. And some examples here of some objectives that people might want to consider are promoting access to care, achieving program sustainability, improving health, increasing accountability. As we just discussed, it's extremely difficult to establish accountability when there's a great deal of confusion about who's really paying for health care. One of the ways I've heard this described is that the most people who have insurance think of it in terms of someone else paying for the cost of their health care. And to the extent that that is true, people don't make choices about whether to seek care or what kind of care to get with any kind of consideration of the cost. Better outcomes for lower costs. This again gets back to trying to establish what gain there's going to be in health for the dollar spent and what kinds of health care or health coverage are going to give us the best return. Then another issue is building, or another possible objective is building provider capacity and better infrastructure. This gets to whether we have enough nurses, whether we have enough doctors in every specialty, and what the delivery system looks like and how well established it is and how effective at getting care to people who need it. The second policy question, general question, is who should be eligible for what programs, for FEOP, for OMAP, Medicaid, and CHIP, and for FEOP. And the next is how should the public programs like OMAP, Medicaid, CHIP, and the private parts of the OHP work together, given the pressures on public and private resources. I think this is a really important area. One of the things that we are going to be doing with FEOP is offering people, in effect, a choice. They may be eligible, there may be children in the family who are eligible to get onto Medicaid or more likely the CHIP program, but the family may decide it wants to keep the children with the parents on the employer-sponsored insurance. And there's evidence that when the family is covered together under the same insurance plan, there's a greater likelihood that the children are going to get in for the care that they need, just because the family doesn't have to negotiate two systems. And I think the better we are at making these two programs work together, the more effective we're going to be at keeping people insured. The next set of policy questions starts off with funding. And the question, as it's phrased here, is how much funding is needed and how much is reasonable. How much should come from the general fund, how much from new revenue dedicated to paying for health care, and how should that new revenue be raised. The next is how should benefits and cost sharing be shaped to meet policy objectives and be sustainable, given the amount of funding that's available. And I guess the issue here is really what benefit package with what levels of cost sharing is going to operate so that people are encouraged to seek the kind of care that we want to be sure they have access to, but not encouraged to overutilize care that may be more expensive and have not the same impact on health. The next question is how should provider payment levels be determined to meet policy objectives and be sustainable, again, given available funding. All through the history of the Oregon Health Plan, we've talked about the importance of paying for the cost of care, not underpaying, not contributing to cost shifting. Well, one of the questions that raises is how do you establish a payment level that does cover the cost of care? And I think we need to think more about that. The next question is how to involve the public in the process. And I made the point a little bit earlier that I think it's very important that we ask the people who are going to be covered by whatever health coverage plan, what is it that's important to you in the way of which benefits are covered? And where does it make most sense to have cost sharing? I think this was done successfully in building the prioritized list, as I said, for the current demonstration project. I think it could be done again. And then how do you involve stakeholders in this process? The people who provide the care, the people who purchase it, other parties who have some stake. And that's the end of my presentation. The last two pages identify some of the sources that were used to pull the information together. But that's the end of what I have prepared, Mr. Chair.
And we thank you. Anything you'd like to add at this juncture, Bruce? Any particular questions the committee has? Representative March.
Thank you. FEOP.
Yes.
Currently, does any part of FEOP count under our waiver, and i.e. so we're getting Medicaid dollars to pay for that?
It does.
So
we're bringing it under the waiver. We're getting Medicaid match.
Okay. Yes. Are we getting it at the same rate as the rest of the program, and i.e. if we, you're talking about making it so that the children, for example, could be covered under the employer plan. If we subsidize that, we'd still get the same amount.
That's right. We've constructed the waiver to make sure that wherever possible we get the higher match rate for children. The CHIP program has a slightly higher match rate, and we're getting reimbursed. The federal match from the federal government is for new eligibles at that CHIP rate. For some of the people who are already on, it may be at the Medicaid rate.
Right. And so that, and then the CHIP, the for children, the rate is higher than.
Correct.
So if we change the age of childhood to be like 25, we'd get more money.
Maybe worth a try. That's exactly right, Representative Cruz. We've never tapped the full allocation of CHIP funds available.
General fund contribution.
Maybe.
Oh, maybe. He's getting clever. Okay, I've got a question. I mean, you know, you got three basic parts to this thing. I mean, you got benefits, eligibles, and reimbursements. And, you know, we're looking at a finite amount of resources. And so you adjust, finesse, tweak, massage, benefits, any of those. Well, particularly benefits or eligibles. You move those down, you're going to have people that are either eligible now that won't be eligible, or people that are currently eligible would remain eligible that don't get the benefits. So they're drifting off to the nearest emergency room, getting the medical care, and that's getting shifted to employers and employees.
You're absolutely right. And so the cost is still being borne somewhere.
And that's assuming we don't mess with any reimbursement rates to keep the physicians, the providers in the system.
In the state.
You said it.
Well, Dr. Goldberg, I mean...
No, I mean, every... If you... Each of these has an up and a downside. Obviously, if you increase eligibility and provide, we lower our uninsurance rate, we do some good things. We provide more access to health care. We provide, we get a healthier citizenry, a more productive citizenry. That's a good thing. By the same token, and we lower the cost shift. We then have everybody who's insured getting the cost of that is being paid for, and there isn't a cost shift. But obviously, the more eligibles, the more dollars that it's going to cost. You decrease the eligibility, we then have more and more ill people in our society, more and more people unable to work. We have people who are still getting sick and who will still be consuming healthcare resources, and that cost will be still be borne by somebody. When you look at the benefits side, it's the same issue. There's a place in which you're providing when you lower a benefit. And if you don't provide it and it's a needed service, you're going to have the problem of, in essence, the person is uninsured for that. They can't get that service. If we choose, as we've seen, if we cut back on mental health care benefits, there's going to be a cost that's incurred somewhere for that. People will, their mental illness doesn't go away. They're still going to end up in emergency rooms. that cost will be borne by somebody. By the same token, we don't want to provide benefits that don't have any good. We don't want to be paying for services that provide no improvement in life, in outcomes, improvement in health, that provide any benefit. If there's a cheaper way to deliver a service and it provides the same outcome, that's the benefit you want to cover. It's easily said. It's very difficult to do. The abilities for us to grapple with those questions societally are hard. But the issue is to try and find the equilibrium, is to try and find how can we provide the greatest a benefit which provides good, healthy outcomes to the most people in our state that we can afford to do.
Any questions?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess, again, I'm speaking as a novice, so I may be way off track here, but the big insight of the Oregon Health Plan was to rank services by, is it high cost, low value, or low cost, high value, and stick the things that essentially produce more value for the dollar higher on the list? And is there any reason to rethink that core piece of the way that the Oregon system is designed, or is this an idea that has now spread to other states and seems to be the logical way to go?
What you're referring to is what is the best way to limit a benefit?
Mm-hmm.
And you can limit a benefit in a variety of ways. You can limit a benefit by simply saying, we'll take this group of services and we won't pay for it. We won't pay for dental care, or we won't pay for pharmaceuticals, or you can limit benefits in that way.
Okay.
Or there could be other ways of limiting benefits. The way that we've gone in Oregon has been to rank services and look at where it is that we can afford to limit that benefit. It hasn't been widely replicated. Part of that is we also haven't had the ability to raise and lower that line as we had anticipated. The ability of the state to change that line has been curtailed by the federal government. It, in principle, was a very reasonable process whereby citizens and healthcare professionals got together and looked at the utility of a service and ranked them. And it was a conversation that included public input and professional expertise, and a list was made up. It's a difficult... The question is, How do you limit that benefit? Where do you put that, the ability to do that? Do we want to have physicians limit the benefit? Do we want the legislature to limit the benefit? How do we do that? I personally feel that in many ways that was the beginnings of a process. I think that it can be refined, that there are ways to get at some of what we've been talking about, whereby that a diagnosis may have many, many treatments, some of which are more expensive and not of any greater benefit than others. And you would want to limit the treatments to particular ones. That's what has begun to happen, for instance, with pharmaceuticals, is looking at and I know many of you are very familiar with what's gone on with that, but it's a very similar process. But I think others have other ideas, and I think that's what we need to do, is explore what is the way here in Oregon that we're going to look at what is a basic benefit, and how do we decide on what that is? That's the question.
If I can follow up. given we heard earlier that the federal government has provided greater flexibility in regard to waivers, so you mentioned that the federal government hadn't let us kind of add or subtract off the list. Has that changed, or do we anticipate that changing, that we may have greater flexibility there now?
Not a great deal of flexibility, no, Representative Merkley. There may be a little bit more, but they've been pretty consistent in their resistance to any significant movement of the line on the list.
We did move away from the waiver, but not very much.
Not very much, that's right. We've not had the latitude we expected to be able to move that line adjust benefits.
And as either your testimony or perhaps Representative Cruz shared with us that, I mean, there are some states, and I think Utah is the model, where they actually got a waiver to provide, you know, lower benefits than required by Medicaid. Right? I think there's more flexibility there.
Whether it's a good system,
yeah,
that's
right.
The waiver was allowed.
Yeah,
that's right.
I'm not commenting on their system. I'm just saying I think that's an indicator, and you know, and I appreciate your comments about ideas and creativity, because that's what we've got to be. We must be all about. Representative Bates.
Just real quick, a few comments on the list so we won't misunderstand what it is and what it does. The list ranked diagnosis and the treatment for the diagnosis based on the outcomes, nothing financial. And you will find the list, the same diagnosis in two different places, one with one treatment showing a very good outcome, high on the list, and the same diagnosis very low on the list showing a bad outcome for that treatment, so that one is preferred over the other. The cost then was based on what each one of those lines looked like, and so the legislature then had the right under the state legislation to move up that list wherever they wanted to and say, we're not paying for anything, you know, below this part of the line. The federal government looked at that list with us and said, we'll allow you some ability to move up, but at a certain point, we think you're denying people a basic benefit that's life-threatening that you can't not go above. And that's basically what happened. We can probably, we think now, move the line 30 or 40 lines. I've asked OMAP to give me an impact of that, what that would be financially for changing that benefit package on the line. But we don't want to think that it was based on financial, because it wasn't. It was based on outcomes and ranking the most important things first and the least important last. For instance, I think number one's probably some kind of a trauma situation, I think.
Head trauma.
Is it head trauma? Is that what I remember? The most likely, you know, what's the impact of taking care of the head trauma as far as saving lives and morbidity? And you go down that list in that direction.
Question there. But weren't some things that were necessary to live, if you will, and I'm going back to the whole transplant debate that was in the press, weren't they ranked very low because because they were extraordinarily expensive?
No. Some of the transplants were ranked very low because the outcomes at that time were so terrible.
I see.
And that you could actually show that people would probably live longer without getting a transplant than getting a transplant. We actually found, as the transplants improved, that not only would they save lives and live longer, they were actually cheaper to give someone a transplant than not getting a transplant because the cost of maintaining those people through their illness for, say, cirrhosis of the liver was more expensive than giving them a transplant. Okay. So it really was based on outcomes. And those outcomes have changed as years have gone by, as new treatments came along and things got better.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that it seemed to me that in the land of the free and the home of the brave, maybe we ought to leave some of the decisions more to the patient, that the program should be outlined so that they have a choice or more of a choice, and they can pick a very basic level program just to get them out of trouble and have a high deductible, or they can pick something that's very expensive. But to let the insurance companies design programs that will tell us to give choice, and some of these would fit in, some of these wouldn't fit into to OHP. But it seems to me what I'm hearing and what I'd like to see us do is working along lines of FEAP or at least the employer-employee range to have some basic programs that are market-driven, that will provide care, low-cost care, or as low-cost as possible, to those who don't have any care now, and then maybe reduce the And I understand what Dr. Bates is saying, that there's some procedures that better to do them even though they're costly. But to reduce some of the more costly procedures, and I think that's what Representative Markley is getting at too, that we're at a place now where we don't have the benefit of giving away everything to everybody. Well, let's see where we can cut down to give basic care to many and then go as high as we can with the costs that we have, or with the revenues we have.
Sounds like
Mr. Chair.
The same old thing.
I'm not sure if I caught your idea correctly, but were you thinking, Representative Anderson, that a plan might, for example, give a low-income individual a choice between, say, a higher deductible and a greater range of services that would be covered, everything's covered, but the list doesn't go down as far, and there were several different options within the same plan?
Yes, and also the thing I'm concerned about is I can make good choices or bad choices regarding my health. I can overeat day after day after day, as I've been doing the last week.
Yeah, me too.
I can take drugs. I can do things that are really harmful to my body. And what I'd like to see is that there are plans where people could opt out of those bad choices and get good insurance because they're making good choices. And then there'd be other plans where people who don't make those good choices, they can have a plan too, but it's going to cost them more. And that's just forcing prevention in my mind. I'm a newcomer here, but it just seems to me that we need to honor people's choices. And if they want to make bad choices, that's fine, but they're going to have to pay more for that. The general society shouldn't pay for people making awful choices.
Okay. Mm.
Any other questions at this juncture? You gentlemen, both of you gentlemen, have been incredibly generous with your time, and I'd like to impinge on your generosity one more time and invite you back Monday, both you, Dr. Goldberg, and you, Mr. DePriest, to see if we can flesh some of this out, concentrate maybe on a couple more of the panels where I sense there's some concerns, indeed confusion.
Very well. We'll be glad to.
We're going to try, just for the as a general operating standard, we'll try to keep this committee. I know it's late in the afternoon and people are starting to get tired and minds are starting to drift and we didn't have coffee today, Kelly. The what?
Or
cookies, Kelly. Find those leftover cookies. The
Diet Pepsi.
We'll go up to 2-day-old cookies.
No fat, no sugar cookies, though. Right?
That's right. That's for Representative Anderson.
I'll bring those.
You know, the rest of us want the high tech stuff. We're willing to pay the insurance rate. But anyway, if we can invite you back, and if I could encourage the committee members to think about questions, maybe review this material, because I think we're starting to get our arms around this. I mean, it's weighty and it's involved. But as I started to say, I think we'll try to keep this to an hour and a half every day because it is late in the day and it'll allow us to get out of here, you know, return some phone calls between 4:30 and 5 during normal business hours. Any other business come before the committee?
Okay, can I just indulge you for one moment to actually introduce myself to everybody because not everybody was here when
go
I did.
Ahead. A little background, personal bio?
No, that's okay. I just my name and I just want to introduce myself as Bruce Goldberg, and I'm the administrator designee for the Office of Health Policy. And I officially start that designee role February 3rd. I very much look forward to working with everybody here and pledge that what our role will be is exactly as we began today, is to begin to provide some of the information. We didn't come today with solutions. I think that's what we all need to work on, but we're here to provide you with the information as best we can, and please don't hesitate.
Mr. Chair.
Well said. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes, Dr. Goldberg worked for Clackamas County Public Health, where I work. He would come, I think, one day a week.
I was just there last week.
Yes, and everyone respects
him, and he is a wonderful physician. Let's hope he does as well as a policy advisor.
Well, if he doesn't start till the 30, he's down here moonlighting already. We like him.
I will try my best.
We are sure no other business come before the committee.
We are adjourned.